Hi, welcome to CSI on Fire, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the fire investigation community. I'm your host, Mike Molden, and episode after episode we'll attempt to excavate the often difficult but always fascinating world of the fire investigator. Welcome to CSI on Fire, your fire investigation podcast. Got a fantastic guest from Down Under today. I've got Michael Forbes on the podcast. Mike, you know I don't introduce the guests, I let them introduce yourself. So please go ahead, tell us your background, where you come from, and why you're on the podcast today.
Well, g'day, Mike, and g'day to your listeners. Listen, yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me on your podcast. Yeah, my name's Michael Forbes. I've been a firefighter for 30 years with Fire Rescue New South Wales, and I've been in the fire investigation and research unit since 2007. Obviously, been a career firefighter, and I sort of looked at fire investigation. Well, I guess from the start, I came out of the college and was just being a firefighter for a number of years, and then I looked at doing our communication section. So I did a few years at our comm centre, taking the 000 calls, which is the 999 in the UK, but our emergency phone in our comm centre and dispatching fire appliances to incidents. So I did that for about 4 years. I then went over to our hazmat unit. So I was a hazmat technician at Fire Rescue for a couple of years, and that's when I got promoted to station officer. And as a station officer, you move around when you start off. So I moved all over sort of Sydney, relieving, and then I got a permanent station. But then I was sort of still interested in hazmat, went back to the hazmat unit as a station officer. And when I was there, the fire investigation unit was actually next door, and I got to know the fire investigators. So I started doing a couple of ride-alongs with them, and I looked at it and went, wow, this is very interesting, like a big jigsaw puzzle and something you can sort of get your teeth into and try and work out what exactly happened. That really spurred my interest, and I did a graduate certificate in fire investigation at Charles Sturt University in Australia and did a 12-month grad cert course. I managed to complete that just as an advertisement came up for a position at the Fire Investigation Research Unit, FIRU we call it. And I was successful in getting that position. So that was in October 2007 when I first started in the fire unit. So I started doing fires. So we have a process where we just ride along or mentors, a guy mentors you for a month or two, and then you're on your own. Those first 6 months to a year was really eye-opening. It was pretty difficult, hard to work out what was going on. I was sort of looking at other stations and saying, what do you think? And then they would say, oh, I don't know, you're the expert. And it's like, well, yes, but no. So that first year or two was really hard, I thought, but interesting still. And one of the previous legends of Billy Powell sort of said to me, you know, it takes about 7 years to learn how to be a fire investigator. I was like, 7 years, really? But yeah, it took quite a few years. And I thought it was about that three or fourth year I sort of really understood what was going on. Stayed in the unit. I just really enjoy the unit. I really enjoy fire investigation. I did about 14 years as a fire investigator. And then I was moved through the ranks again, and I wanted to get promoted. And I moved over to the fire research team in 2021. So I was doing a couple of years there and then got promoted to the inspector level. And just recently, in the last 12 months, I've been acting up into the manager's role, sort of an acting superintendent. So now I'm running the unit, which, again, I really enjoy because there are three parts or three streams to the FIRU, Fire Investigation Research Unit. We have a fire investigation team. So we have four fire investigators on call 24/7 covering the whole state, which is a pretty big state of 8 million people, only four investigators. And then we have a canine team. So we have the three ignitable liquid detection canines in the Southern Hemisphere. They're a great, great tool that we use. And then we have a fire research team. We have two civilians and two operational firefighters in that team as well. Managing a small team is really good. They're really good people in terms of they're all really committed and really passionate about what they do, and it makes my job as the manager quite easy in the sense that you don't have to worry about them. They're doing really, really good work. And we run about 180 to 200 incidents on the fire investigation side a year, about that 220 incidents for the canines that attend. So the canines also, we have two fire services in New South Wales. We have the Rural Fire Service that look after the majority of the land, so probably about 80, 85% of the land in New South Wales. And then Fire Rescue looks after that about 10 or 15% of the land size, but we look after 80, probably more, 90% of the population in those metropolitan towns. We've got full-time firefighters, retained firefighters. So all up about nearly 7,000 firefighters, both retained and permanent. And it's the biggest fire service in the country. I've been sort of lucky in that sense. because we're in the biggest city. There's about 6 million people in Sydney, so it's quite a large area. We have over 100 fire stations, so we get a lot of fires. And been very lucky to, as a fire investigator, to get exposed to a wide variety of jobs over the time I was doing fire investigation. That's basically been my career at this stage so far.
Yeah, great summary. So how does it work in Australia? Is it any different? I know that just offline we were talking about you attending coroner's court and that sort of stuff. Who has a sort of, is it fire service responsibility to prosecute and investigate, or how does it work?
Yeah, so in New South Wales, again, there's different jurisdictions in the country. Each state has its own sort of fire service, and there's no national sort of fire service. So New South Wales Police essentially investigate fires. What does fire rescue do? We just provide that opinion into the origin and cause. As a fire investigator, when a fire occurs, the reporting officer, the first arriving officer at that scene, takes charge of that scene. They have responsibility to extinguish, to make safe, and then obviously do an initial origin and cause investigation into the fire. Now, if they can't work it out, they then call us, and we can then provide assistance either by the phone, video conferencing, or we can actually attend. Because there's only two on-call fire investigators 24/7, it makes it a bit hard the distances we have to go. So from east to west, from Sydney to our western border, can take you 10, 12 hours drive. To the north, it takes about 8 hours, and to the south, about 6 hours from Sydney. It's a big area that we cover. Getting to those regional areas can take a bit of time. If they suspect a crime has occurred or we don't know, then New South Wales Police will take control of the site and they will declare a crime scene. Then their crime scene officers will then come in and investigate the fire with us. Generally, we have to have a crime scene officer standing next to us when we investigate the fire, because they are legislated under the Crimes Act to move or remove any evidence and seize evidence. We, again, are invited in from them. So they have to be signed off. So they have to be fire investigators themselves. So New South Wales crime scene, they have about 110, 120 crime scene officers that are fire trained. Obviously, we've only got four. They are obviously rely heavily on us because all we do is fire. Yet crime scene officers in New South Wales Police, they do everything. They have to be signed off for murders, for sexual assaults, for shootings, stuff like that, and fire. We find that when we were turning up to these scenes, they look to us for that expertise. And then New South Wales Police detectives, they run the job, so they're officer in charge of an incident or a fire in their area. So they will obviously look to us again, saying, give us your opinion, so a statement. If it's a significant fire and unknown, so it goes to the coroner, so all those fires are reportable to the New South Wales coroner. But yeah, if it's criminal, then obviously they sort of write up a brief of evidence, and the brief of evidence then is given to the prosecutors, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions in New South Wales, and then it's then prosecuted through the criminal sort of system.
Gotcha. Okay, fantastic.
Other states is a little bit different. Victoria, it's a little bit different. Police will do everything down there, and essentially if it's a deliberate fire in Victoria, the fire investigators aren't allowed to actually come in to the scene. They won't let them in, which is a bit of a shame. In WA, the New South Wales Police Arson Unit do the crime scene as well. The detectives actually do the crime scene as well. So little states have just their slight little variations, but each state in fire service has a fire investigation unit. We sort of come together as well, and that's the other thing that I do is there's AFAC, which is the Australasian Fire Authority Council. For all the any service, any public agency that has a fire investigation service sits on a fire investigation network. So it's called the FIN Group. And I'm chair of that as well. So we come together, you know, once a year. We have this obviously a great network where fires coming up, you know, this type of fire, or they bounce ideas off things. Big problem at the moment is lithium ion batteries. So the FIN Group is actually, you know, talking to each other about how we're dealing with fire, lithium ion batteries. We've had the first few fatalities now in this country, lithium ion batteries. So that's where the network really comes in handy, so that we can all talk to each other to be able to say, what are you doing? How are you guys doing it? And stuff like that.
Very similar to UK in terms of first fatalities happening via sort of lithium batteries and e-scooter bikes and that kind of stuff. And how does it work? Because I know you're a little bit unique in separate to UK, not that separate to America, but Australian Federal Police, if you get involved with them, or how's that work?
Australian Federal Police, their jurisdiction is in the ACT, which is the Australian Capital Territory, its own sort of jurisdiction. It's actually inside New South Wales, where the nation's capital is, which is the city of Canberra. So they obviously are the crime scene officers for Canberra and the ACT. And there is a fire service, it's the ACT Fire Rescue inside Canberra. So again, they have a small fire investigation unit. So they will do the crime scene analysis and all that stuff. But there are sort of times when they will deploy. For example, we had on Christmas Island, they had a whole big fires, bunch of fires over there. So the AFP forensics deployed to Christmas Island, which is an island off the northwest of Australia, where they do immigration detention and stuff like that. They have the ability, and also we have in the Pacific areas, there were some number of fires in the Solomon Islands or in Vanuatu. So the AFP forensics deployed to those countries to assist their country. They invited them in to assist in some of the fires that were happening over there, some arsons and stuff like that. They are, I guess, the national representative when a crime occurs. I know that the AFP, for example, deployed to the MH17 air disaster. I know it wasn't a fire, but certainly the DBI and the assisting of, you know, crime scene stuff, they deployed over there. So we do work with them. They have their own fire investigation course. We sort of teach on those courses and provide advice and stuff like that. So again, they're part of the network around the country, and we train together, attend workshops together, conferences and things like that. So we see them all the time.
Oh, good. You kind of sounds like you're well joined up in your communication, and that's all good.
Yeah, and that's the big thing around fire investigation. I've heard all your guests previously about what it means to be a fire investigator is certainly to us is the networking. And your 1033 document says you've got to keep your education up. And as part of that education, we're a little bit of the poor cousins in Australia. Like I keep telling my bosses that for us in Australia, it's really hard to get fire investigation training because it's all overseas. I've been lucky to be able to go overseas a few times to get that training because you have to do this yourself. You can't sit back and just wait for the training to come to you. And I guess what I've tried to do over the years is provide opportunities for training. And I'm also president of the New South Wales Association of Fire Investigators. That's chapter 47 of the IAAI. And we have done over the years is bring courses from the IAAI over here. We've done the motor vehicle fire investigation course twice now to bring it to Australia. And this year we're planning on bringing the 40-hour fundamentals fire investigation course to Australia, to Sydney actually, in October. And that's, I guess, what I feel is lacking in Australia is that real, that introductory fire course. Rather than doing it online in a computer, you know, we're going to set up fire cells at our facility. We can do some burns and, you know, offer a course that new investigators and even experienced investigators can come in, refresh their skills, because there's just nothing like that in this country where a fire investigator, whether they're new or experienced, can actually go into a burnt cell that we know exactly what's happened and actually pull it apart, get your hands dirty, and then sort of see the video at the end. I know we have our own training in Fire Rescue New South Wales. We train our station officers, and we changed the way we train our station officers about 3 years ago, 2020, where they came to me and said, we want to change it now. We want to make it face-to-face. And because it was just online, the station officers are doing their fire investigation training. So I said, listen, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it properly. So we've got this facility that we can do test burns in Northwest Sydney. And I set a fire out there. And now the station officers, I give them 2 days of theory. And then the third day we go out and they go out and investigate a scene. And then they come back and they write up their opinion. And it's actually happening this week and on Tuesday. They've done the training last week, and Tuesday they actually come in and I give them a mock court, and I'm like the judge and the defense and the prosecution all in once, and we put them under pressure, and we actually, you know, give them some hard questions. Words matter. So tell us, what are you actually saying, and definitions and things like that. And that gives us a taste of what we do at FIAU as a fire investigator. But these are the people that are going to the scenes, those first responders that are attending, and they just need to be upskilled, and they just haven't had that in the past. And the last 3 or 4 years, we've trained the 200 officers now within Fire Rescue New South Wales to be actually really upskill a component and then utilise what FIRU is about, which is assisting frontline firefighters in their origin and cause determination.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. I think there's nothing to replace. I mean, we've got some river software at the Nafarab University and stuff, but there's nothing really to replace having a live burn and then digging out afterwards. And just you just can't replace that, I think. And I think the mock court thing is fantastic because does allow you to make mistakes in that kind of safe environment. And I always think you take much more out of the things that you've missed or the things that have been pointed out in peer checking, review and stuff. You go, and you never forget those sort of things. We were just chatting offline about how we came to be discussing, and I didn't actually find you through the New South Wales Association. Well, I did in a way, but I found you via the YouTube channel because I just searched up fire investigation, and it's parcel of that. Some really good stuff on there, and I know you're president, and some really good stuff on there. I'm going to give him a shout because I think it's a real fundamental. It's Tim Ryan. And just tell us what Tim Ryan came on and did for your thing and some of the other online courses that you've got or online seminars that you've got there, Mick.
Yes, I've been president there for 10 years. I've been a member since 2007. But I guess when I became president, our big thing is around education, just providing those opportunities. And it's really hard, as I said, but we generally have an education night once every second month. So probably five or six a year we offer. And we just try and get different people on and just get them to talk about it. It's roughly in the fire investigation industry. Sometimes it's not. We also have relationships with the Australian New Zealand Forensic Science Society. We share their education nights and they share ours. We get some people from ANSPIS coming on. And whoever's interesting talker, we get them on. So Tim's a firefighter. He's been there a 20-year-plus career. And he was in our firefighter training team. So he was teaching recruits all the basics around fire behavior, fire dynamics. Obviously, we'd seen at our academy and stuff like that. I was told by a friend, I said, you should get him on because he really explains it. And when I did see it in the classroom, I said, yeah, actually, that's pretty good. So I just said that to him. I said, listen, why don't you come on and talk about what you talk about, which is just the basics of fire and basics of fire dynamics and how it all works when, you know, inside a compartment and stuff like that. And this is pre-COVID. Pre-COVID, we used to just start recording our education, mainly because we've got about 160 members or so, but it's very hard for them to get into Sydney and be in Sydney and see these education nights because we were doing it face-to-face. This is all pre-COVID stuff. We didn't know what Zoom was. So we would record it, and then we just create our own YouTube channel and just put them on there just so that other people can see them. He did one, and then it actually took off. It's the biggest one we've had, and I can't remember how many views it is, but it's like over 10,000 views or something. I think it's so popular because it's nice and simple, and he just breaks it down and he talks really well, nice and clear and concise, and just makes it easier for the viewer to understand. And every time I do see him, he sort of comes up to me and says, how's my YouTube site going? Is it still the first? And I said, yep, you're out there by a long way.
Now you can say he's got mention on here.
Yes, so I'll have to share this podcast with him now. It'll make him feel real good.
His is really good, and the whole education thing's fantastic, and that's basically what it's all about really today and for your YouTube channel. But I think just taking it from that very basics one, which he does fantastically well, and it's the first one I came across. I'll be honest with you, I've watched it several times just to get it into the brain, but you've taken it right up to modern day. The last one I watched of yours was by EV Fire Safe, which takes us right up to date with kind of lithium batteries and stuff. So that's obviously an emerging problem.
Yeah. Obviously, we've got, like every other fire service in the world, we're dealing with more and more of these incidents. Even though it hasn't really got into motor vehicles or EV vehicles, we've only had 6 confirmed EV fires in Australia, which is a very small number compared to, say, the US. But there's only about 180,000 EV vehicles, full EV vehicles in this country. And, yeah, EV Fire Safe are sort of becoming sort of a little bit bigger and well-known in the EV sort of space. And yeah, again, one of my committee members sort of suggested, let's get Emma Sutcliffe on from that. And I was like, oh, great. Actually, we had an EV fire in New South Wales where something fell off the back of the truck, went under the Tesla and ripped the battery right through, went into a thermal runaway on the highway, one of the main highways in New South Wales. And anyway, that vehicle got towed down to Tesla in Melbourne. They were able to actually pull it apart. And that's something that obviously fire investigators are very interested in, and we said, come on in. And they'd only just sort of finished that sort of investigation and they were able to talk about it. So it was really good timing for us, but it was really good to be able to see that because, again, it's an emerging issue. But for fire investigators, what I wanted them to do is to try and talk about the safety when we're investigating these type of fires, because there are a lot more risks around investigating these type of devices or vehicles. Yeah, that's a big thing as well that everyone should be thinking about all the time. And I thought it was really, really good. So, yeah, we got a lot of people interested in that because she's very popular on LinkedIn and things like that, so people get to see it. So it was good.
I think what I really liked about that one was that when they placed the actual piece of debris that caused the damage, and they kind of, you could physically put it back into where the damage was, and that was basic kind of real forensic, kind of just real observational, putting things back like a jigsaw. Oh, okay, that literally fits in there. So that was fantastic.
Yeah, and that's the same at a fire scene, isn't it? Like you go there and you find the device and you just go, oh, this is what it is. Sometimes you reconstruct and you see a piece that's missing and you go, oh, hang on, I think I know where that came from. It is that jigsaw puzzle, which is what we're all trying to do, isn't it? We're all trying to solve that puzzle. It doesn't happen every time, but when it does, man, you feel good.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Let's move on to, I know you talked about the association and the chapter, et cetera. I know you've got something coming up in October. Do you just want to, and I saw some call out for papers and stuff, so just brief us about that, mate.
Yeah, for sure. New South Wales AFI is hosting the next Australasian Association of Fire Investigation Conference, so it's AAFI. So there are four chapters that make up the Australasian. So there's Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and New Zealand. And every 2 years we come together to do our conference. So it was in 2022, it was in Queensland. So this year we're hosting it. We last hosted it in 2016. So yeah, we're calling out for people to give us an abstract. It's going to be in October, so 21st and 22nd of October. And then we're actually having a field day. So we're actually asking for people around lithium-ion batteries and fire investigation is the theme. We've got Cameron Novak coming out from the US. So he's an electrical engineer with the ATF. So he's going to come out and give like an electrical demonstration. So we're going to burn some devices, some common devices here in Australia, electrical devices, and we're going to sort of have them burnt. And then he's going to give like a demonstration on how, well, you know, the points to look for in a fire investigation, how to pull things apart, what to look for. But we're also going to have a wildfire component. So a big part of our association is RFS members. That's obviously their interest, which is wildfires. So we've got one of the biggest experts in the country, Richard Woods. He's going to come up. He's from Canberra, so he's going to come up. And we've got an area in our facility as well, our Londonderry Fire Research Facility, that's all grass and bush. So we're going to set some fires prior to the conference. People that are interested on that, they can go over to the wildfire section, and Richard will walk you through a number of small little fires that we're going to set. So he's going to have like a theory component, obviously, within the conference, and then on the practical side on the Wednesday, he's going to be out there in the field. We're going to have people trying to flag the wildfires, trying to work out where the origin is, see if they can see any ignition sources, things like that. And also, because we're doing the 40-hour the week before part of the conference, the cells from that will still be there. So you can walk through the cells, you can go to the electrical side with Cameron, or you can go to the Wi-Fi side of Richard. So that practical day, that infield day, will give you a few options to walk around. So we did the same sort of thing in 2016 when we had Steve Carman come out here, and he did a practical sort of burn about his thing, which is ventilation and elevated origins. That worked really well. So that's what we're trying to continue that theme. At least get out into the actual field and with your colleagues and come down and have a bit of fun there. So that's 3 days, the 21st, 22nd and 23rd of October. It's going to be held in Western Sydney, the Western Sydney Conference Centre, which is a nice brand new facility. And yeah, come on down under and you'll get to see it all happen down there.
Brilliant. Fantastic. I actually had Richard Woods on. He's not come out yet, but I had him, Roderick Jones and Rich came on. It's the first ever time that we had three on the podcast, if that makes sense. Some fascinating investigative techniques and kind of dispelling some myths around things like that and stuff. Yeah, fantastic.
Very experienced. And that training is his thing. And he trains a lot, especially overseas around wildfire. So we get to use him for our conference, which will be great.
Fantastic. Let's move on. I'll put all these dates, and if you've got any links and stuff, we'll put them all on the podcast notes, if that's okay. Let's move on to, probably might start to embarrass you now, but I know that you're the IWI Investigator of the Year in 2023. Just talk us through that, what happened there, and take us through the case if you can.
Well, it was a big surprise. Sunday, I got a phone call from Rose, who's an IWI Director in charge of the awards. I'm like, oh, by the way, you've just won the Investigator of the Year. I said, for what? I didn't even know I was nominated. A friend of mine, Ross Brogan, who is one of the legends in New South Wales. He was one of the original members of the Fire Investigation Unit when it was formed in 1987. He was the first fire investigator there, ex-New South Wales AFI member as well, long-time friend. He nominated me just quietly because I was involved in this case, and he was also involved in the case and did a review of my statement for the prosecution. So this case, I call it sort of woman on fire, and it's a case that came to me in 2015. So the incident occurred in 2013, and I didn't actually attend the incident, but it was before. And the coroner actually said, have you got an expert in the origin and cause of the fire? And then the police went, no, we haven't. They rang the arson unit, and the arson unit said, ring Forbesy. So they rang me. So they came down, gave me the brief, and when I read the brief, I sort of said, well, this woman was found fully engulfed in flames, walking down her driveway with her husband behind her trying to put out the fire. And when I went to brief, I sort of said, well, I think if we're going to do this, we're going to have to set someone on fire. And so I said that to my boss, and he went, what? And then I said it to the police, and they went, what? But then I sat him down and said, listen, we can just get a stunt person and stunt woman, stunt man, and we can just do it that way and get some mannequins and things like that. And then once they thought about it, they went, okay, let's do it. The facility that we use, it's good for these type of things. We can sort of do what we want. And so I went out to the site and I measured it, and then I put that on the ground and measured the distances. And we managed to get a stunt woman, and she had a team of four or three other colleagues and her. And they were in charge of sort of their safety, and we were just obviously observing. And we had a whole bunch of mannequins, so we had 14 sets of clothes. So we tried to sort of do numerous test burns or demonstrations to be able to show what is possible. You know, she was covered in petrol. Top autopsy showed that she had 95% burns, but the only part of the body that wasn't burnt was her head and the bottoms of her feet. So my role or my aim of the testing was to try to replicate her burns. That is, to be able to show how does a body totally burn in terms of all the arms, legs, torso, back, but the head does not. So that was the aim of it. I just couldn't sort of in my head, like, I had to do some tests. So we started doing some tests just with, firstly without petrol, just the clothing to see how that burned, then with petrol, and then we just tried different levels of petrol. Now, they were in charge of her safety, so they were the ones sort of pouring petrol on her and then igniting it. But what we sort of saw was that as soon as you pour the petrol on the body, especially sort of on the torso, and you ignite it, the flash fire occurs. And you can see that, and she starts pushing through to protect the head. But once ignition occurs and you start walking, the head is protected. So then we started thinking, well, okay, she's going to be walking for that head to be protected. But when you pour, and obviously with petrol, petrol is very ignitable. It's an ignitable liquid, but it's very volatile because its flash point's so low. As soon as you open that container, the vapors are coming off. The vapors are coming off. So those lighter components of the petrol comes off, and you're left with the heavy components. Now, when you pour it onto the clothing, the liquid stays there. Now, there was a period of time she called 000, which is the emergency number, 13 minutes prior to the police arriving. So there was a 13-minute period. She rang 000. She said, phone call. She said, my husband just tried to kill me. 13 minutes later, New South Wales Police arrived at the scene, and she was on fire on the nature strip, which is the front porch or the front part of the road, right next to the road. So that 13 minutes, something's happened, and then there's witnesses to see her walking down her driveway, totally on fire, trying to work out what happened. Because of that 13 minutes, after we'd done a few tests, I thought, well, what happens if we pour the petrol and then wait and allow vaporization to occur? Because the petrol can was found in the laundry, but it had the lid on, and it had been placed in the cupboard and the doors were closed. So, and there was still petrol in it. So there was a time that had the pouring, and there was petrol on the tiles. There was petrol on these little rubber carpet mat. Her fingerprints were on the container. I knew that there was vaporization must have something to do with this. When we did that test, when we poured and we waited, and there was a lighter found in the laundry as well with no DNA and no fingerprints in it as well. When we did that test, the fire is very small and only starts out small. Now, if you start walking with a small fire, the fire will spread because it's still in the garments, it's still producing vapors, and now it's spreading because of the walking, but the head is protected. So that's how I came up with my opinion. My opinion was that it was pouring, time of period of vaporization, then ignition occurred. And then we did a number of tests where and on the crime scene there was bits of clothing that had come off, and it took about 20 seconds before clothing came off. So in that time, walking from the laundry to the corner of the house where the first bit of debris was found was about that 20-second mark. So that's how I come up with my opinion. I wrote my opinion, and I was in the coroner's court, you know, 2 weeks later giving that opinion, and it was just about origin and cause for me. My role wasn't to say who lit the fire. It was just about origin and cause. I wrote that opinion for the coroner. So then 2 years later, this was in 2015. So in 2017, the coroner shut down. After that, I gave my opinion in the coroner's court. They shut down the inquest and they gave it to the DPP, recommending charges, I don't know. But then the DPP considered it and it took them 2 years. And then the DPP came back and charged the husband with murder. Now, I, again, wrote an opinion for a coroner's court. Now it's in a criminal court. It was quite different. And then 2 years later, we had a murder trial. So I'm off to the murder trial. The week before the murder trial, the Crown prosecutor brought me into the office and said, Michael, thank you for your testing. It was really, really good, but we're not going to use it. And I'm like, what? How? That's how I got my opinion. I was, yes, well, the testing, it's too risky because there was a previous trial in New South Wales where a professor did some testing for, another murder trial. And in the Criminal Court of Appeal in New South Wales, it was thrown out because that professor was not an expert in that area. He shouldn't have done those type of tests. It shouldn't have been allowed. But I said, I'm an expert in fire. I'm doing fire investigation. I'm doing fire tests. This is more in my expert's lane. You know, I'm in my lane. And they said, we're not going to use it. And I said, how are you going to get it? Because I would never have got that opinion if I had not done it. Oh, we're going to do use your knowledge training experience, Michael, and we'll get the opinion out of that. I'm like, very frustrated. The defense was allowed to use my report, though. They definitely used my report, and they can do that. Anyway, trial happens, and it's a hung jury. Then we had to come back again. Now we're now in COVID. So the second trial was in 2021, and a second trial, again, the same thing. They wouldn't use the testing, and it come back, and he was acquitted. And that's fine, and, you know, it doesn't really worry me about the result. I just wanted to get that testing in admissible in court because I'd done so much work, but it was too prejudicial to the accused. So for what I do now, and that's one thing I have done over many years, is I like, if I don't know what's happened, I want to be able to do some testing around it or some demonstrations, and we've got the facility to do it, so we do it. And I try to demonstrate what's possible and what's not possible and get a better understanding, because I find that with fire, I think you know what's going to happen until you actually do a demonstration. You go, oh, I wasn't expecting that, because of a lot of variables involved in it. It's very, very hard to replicate exactly what happened at a scene. It's not really like research, or it's not really a test or replication of what you're doing. It's more just a demonstration of what's possible. You try and relay that to the court. So what we do now is, if police come to us with these type of incidents, I come up with a test schedule or a demonstration schedule, and I send it back to the police and I say, get your legal, your prosecutors, to have a look at the schedule and get them to sort of approve it so that it has the best chance of being made admissible in a court. And I've got another case coming up next month where the same thing happened in South Australia, a similar case, and they want an expert. I said, listen, let's do some demonstrations. We did some demonstrations, and it's another murder trial, and I'm in court next month for that. So hopefully that one, I believe, it will be admissible in court, all the testing we did, and that's another case study. Once it's all finished out, hopefully I'll publish it somewhere and in the IAAO journal. But, yeah, very interesting. But I'm a real big believer in trying to reduce testing around fire and demonstrating what's possible and what's not possible, because that's where you learn the most. As we say, you've got to burn to learn.
Yeah, nice. I like that. Well, I'm going to nick that, that's for sure. I think we were just chatting offline, and I think we suffer as well in the fire investigation world from the CSI effect as well, what's called the CSI effect. It often takes sort of video evidence sometimes, or demonstrations, as you said, or practicals, to actually show what's happening, because there is a perception that it's the old cigarette in ignitable liquid kind of mentality. And that's what jurors see on the films, and they watch Backdraft and these sorts of things. And the perception is Backdraft, where you can see all the actors, there's no smoke, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's really, really important. And as I said, we were just chatting offline. I showed a senior investigating officer a couple of videos, and that completely kind of awakened that person to the realities of what I was not very well trying to describe can be shown through a series of tests, and that sort of penny drops. I think it's absolutely fantastic that you're doing that kind of stuff.
And I've had that exact same case as well. So, again, we turned up to a house fire. There's petrol all through the joint. The owner comes out and says, listen, I was just carrying my petrol containers through the house. They were full, and some petrol came out. I had a cigarette, and it dropped on the ground and just started. I went, hey, let's do that. So I went out to our Londonderry site, and I got the petrol, and I shaked it around on the carpet, and then I lit a cigarette, and I threw it on the ground, and it doesn't happen. So, yeah, you've got to actually show these things, what's possible and what's not possible. Firstly, understand it for yourself, but then try and tell others, tell the other story, like tell the police, and then obviously a court. You've really got to burn to learn.
even FIs, I think FIs have some, we know, you know, in the past there's been some misconceptions, some myths. John Lentini does a lot of work on the myths of fire investigation. And I think, but we are all subject to our cognitive bias. You know, I remember watching Backdraft whenever that came out. I don't care to remember, a few years ago. When you watch that stuff, that is, whether you like it consciously or unconsciously, that is in the back. And you've got to unlearn those sorts of misconceptions, I think.
Yeah, that's what I teach. When I'm teaching a lot, I teach this as well. There are a lot of myths out there, and the books that are out there are there to read so that you can sort of educate yourself to trying to understand if they are a myth or not. And if you're still unsure, do the test yourself. We're privileged in the sense that we do have a facility here in New South Wales to do that type of testing. But as a fire service, there should be some place somewhere where you can actually conduct some type of small tests and stuff like burn things, because we are a fire service. You know, if you've got a fire service, you're surely somewhere you can burn. But you get out there and do it, because that is where the most learnings occur.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there's enough, I'm not advocating large-scale tests or anything, but there's a, in the back garden, in a cleared area, you know, 5 metres from the non-flammable items. You know, I've done some tests in the back of my garden type thing, just on a small scale, just get that concept and see if I'm thinking, if what I'm thinking is right. Or 9 times out of 10, it's actually thinking, I'm looking at something like, and something's saying to me, that just doesn't seem right. The ventilation effects, or just building a little model or doing some testing, has always worked for me anyway.
I've actually done it at a scene. You've seen something burn. I'm like, hey, what is that? You know, you just grab it from the scene and then take it outside and then try and burn it, or understand, should that burn? Can it burn? What's it burn like? Just do it from the scene. And simple, yeah, exactly. Test while you're there.
Yeah, a little burn test on. Like, I had a big job actually, and there was some material that was a question whether it will burn or whether it won't burn. It's just getting a small amount to see if it's, A, it's ignitable, when it continues to burn. It's invaluable, really. But okay, fantastic. I think we're doing really well. We're filling the time. But if there's a top tip or trick, or is there one thing that you've learned over the years, make to sort of pass on to the fire investigation community, whether you're a student or whether you've been doing it for 30 years?
Yeah, I've heard this through your podcast. It's a good tip, so I've been thinking about it. But yeah, I always say, I didn't read 921 until about 4 years doing this job. And what I tell fire investigators now is read it day one. Day one, just sit down and start reading NFPA 921, because essentially your whole job is in that book. Everything that you need to do. And I attended a very large explosion in Roselle in Sydney in 2014. It's the 10th anniversary this year, actually. And I turned up, and it was a massive explosion and then fire. 3 people were died, and it was a full collapse, 2-level building. And I turned up there, had no idea what to do. It was the biggest scene I had ever seen, and took 8 hours, probably 10 hours before we got the bodies out. And then we had to work out, we actually had to demolish another building, like a whole 2-level corner building, to get to the scene. So those negotiations with the police took 6 days before we could actually get into the scene. And then we had to excavate the scene for 3 days. So that's a really big job. And then we found a whole bunch of petrol through the joint, and the owner was charged. There was another murder trial, off to murder trial, my first murder trial. He was found guilty. I spent 10 days at this scene, and then I went back to the office and started to write up my statement and stuff like that. I'm thinking, explosions, you know, like, well, I should, what 91 says about explosions. I read the explosions chapter and I went, oh, I should have done that. Oh, I should have done that. And I just realized, bloody hell, I've got to keep reading. I've got to keep reading more. So yeah, my certainly top tip is just read 91. A lot of the answers to the questions and a lot of processes of how to do things, it's just in there. The answers are all there. Yes, we're still going to be learning, and there's still a mountain that you don't know, and you won't ever know it all. So you always continue to sort of understand that there's always something more to learn. But yeah, the basics of fire investigations in that book, and you should know it, and you should read it.
I think it's a common language as well. If you read the book and you do the terminology, it gives us that, whether you're in Australia or whether you're in South America. I interviewed Ricardo Torres yesterday, and it doesn't matter where you are, if you can get together and you can speak a common language in terms of fire, then you know.
Yeah, teach my students, I said, you know, this is the book. There's no Australian book. There's no UK book. It's the NFPA book. We all use it. And I know it says it's a guide and don't have to use it, but all the answers are there. Well, not all of them, but certainly when you're starting out, that's going to be your best reference to get your understandings.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the younger generation that are coming behind us, they'll know nothing different than 921 in the sense of, in the UK, when I first started, I think Roger Ide's book was probably the prevalent one. It's a little guidebooks, you're very small, would never even heard of 921 in that sense. So I think now, if you look at IWAI, obviously, they recommend a separate entity, NAFI, National Association of Fire Investigators in the States. They recommend it. All the chapters around the world obviously kind of work to it. So there's got to be something. If everyone's saying, use this book, there's got to be some logic there.
The court system in the US, you know, sees it as the authoritative text and stuff like that. And certainly Australia, we are a little bit behind in that sense that I would go up to, I speak with prosecutors and I speak with coroners and I said, have you ever heard of 921? They go, no, never heard of it. And you don't expect them to know it. We've got to teach them. We've got to upskill them, the lawyers, about what is supposed to be, how it's supposed to be done. You're always going to have someone on the other side who's going to rubbish you. You've got to show yourself as the credible one and you're following procedure and in the way, the terminology and things like that. So you, to do your best work, you've got to follow the way it should be done. And I think 921 does a long way for that. But yeah, certainly there's other books out there and other ways of doing it, but 921 should be your basis of your knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. Brilliant. Okay. Of course, 1033 kind of sets out what you should and shouldn't know as well.
Again, it's a standard for the US. There's no standard here in Australia. But I try to sort of, again, the US sort of leads the way. I always say US fire investigation industry is this big, which is like very wide. And the fire investigation industry in Australia is only about a centimetre wide. It's a small industry here in this country. And 1033 is a great guide for fire investigators on how you should be training yourself. We use it at Fire Risk in New South Wales as an assessment tool for new fire investigators. So we essentially have a checklist which has come from 1033. So it tells you that the JPRs tell you that a fire investigator should be doing this, this, and this at a scene. So we put that in the assessment. We give our new fire investigators some knowledge. We do ride-alongs. But essentially, you're assessing them on the process. It's not about getting accidental or the deliberate fire. It's about the process. Can you manage a scene from start to finish without anyone coming in and telling you, ah, don't forget about this, don't forget about that? You're not going to get fully right all the time. You're always going to forget things. The process is what is being assessed, and 1033 gives you those processes of what our fire investigators should possess, those JPRs. So that's how we use it.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, it's almost written for you, you know, why reinvent the wheel when it's already there? So, yeah, fantastic. All right, mate. Well, thanks. Listen, we're coming towards the end of our time, unfortunately. Is there anything else? I always like to give a little mop-up session. Is there anything else that we've not discussed that you think is an issue that you want to say about, or is there anything that you really want to sort of highlight today?
No, just for us, we've just had our first fatality for lithium-ion batteries in New South Wales. Queensland have had a couple, and South Australia's had a couple, so we've only had four incidents of fatalities. It's a big issue. Obviously, from a community safety, we are obviously banging on messages around batteries, especially your e-scooters, e-bikes. If you damage them, if you muck around them and try and adapt them and things like that, they're very, very dangerous. What I'm dealing with now at the moment for us is just from a fire investigations perspective, you know, I've got new police calling me saying, what do I do with these batteries? They want to seize them and analyze them, but they're so dangerous, you can't transport them once they've been exposed to fire. So that's a contemporary, very big contemporary issue for fire investigators in Australia and New Zealand at the moment. I guess my message is we look to overseas. We certainly look to overseas, US and FDNY, things like that, about guidance. There's a lot of research in the overseas as well. We're trying to do our own research program within Fire Rescue. It's called the SARET, which is the Safety of Alternate Renewable Energies Technologies Research Program. We're trying to do some testing in Australia using our Londonderry facility, trying to do full EV burns, how sprinklers operate when EVs are in car parks, things like that, get a better understanding for ourselves. So we are in that space doing that, but it's a very big issue. How do we do it? Safety of doing it with fire investigators as well. Who can actually analyze these type of devices as well, these batteries? Like, who is actually qualified to pull apart and actually say this battery caused the fire? Now, that's really difficult. I don't think there's anyone out there that can actually do that. These are the challenges that we have at the moment. So there's always something to challenge you these days. And as a manager now of the unit, yeah, trying to best advise not just my own colleagues, but colleagues around the country is hard. But as you said, having the dialogue there is half the battle. You know, if we're all talking to each other, at least we all know what we're dealing with. So that's going to be the challenge this year, is when we meet again later in the year, to come together and see how the other states are doing it and how overseas is doing it. So, yes, if anyone out there has got good ideas on how to deal with these type of incidents from a fire investigation perspective, please get in touch with me, because I'll listen to anyone. Because, yeah, we're still developing all these procedures, and police want to know now, because I think, unfortunately, we're going to get more fatalities involving these type of devices. So trying to set up processes now is the challenge. But, yeah, it's still good, though. So it's a very enjoyable job.
Yeah. I think the whole lithium battery thing is a worldwide thing. Everyone's looking at UK. I know Danish doing a lot of research into it. Obviously, US, and mentioned the New York Fire Department. They've obviously got a high population area with lots of those e-bikes, that kind of stuff. So, and London Fire Brigade as well, obviously. But yeah, the more research, the wider it goes, and the better. And also, I think it's really important that where possible, I know there's some private firms and there's some commercial interest, because whoever solves it is going to be wealthy. But I think it's really important, just from a, as you said, community safety-wise and preventing fatalities, it's really important to share as much information around it as we can. But yeah, it's difficult to see if it's cause or effect. I think no one's really come up with that solution yet either. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Anyway, Mick, thanks ever so much. I really appreciate your time. As I said to all the guests, without the guests, there would be no podcast, because I wouldn't just sit here for an hour talking to yourself. Although I have done in the past. Thanks so much. I think it just shows today, I think I can see why you're the president. I can see why you're on the Finn Group, because your passion comes across. And thanks very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mike.
No worries, mate. Cheers.
Hey, thank you for listening to CSI on Fire. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and suggest future topics on our webpage. Remember, factor non-verba. Take care. Good hunting. I hope to see you on the next one. Cheers.